A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
When Diplomacy Fails presents.
Hello, and welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hey guys, welcome to When Diplomacy Fails. Welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hello and welcome to
Hello
When Diplomacy
Hello and welcome
fails.
To When Diplomacy Fails.
A project 5 years in the making.
The Franco-Prussian War.
The 7 years war.
Of the When Diplomacy Fails special on Napoleon.
The Crimean War.
To When Diplomacy Fails special on World War I.
The Dutch Revolt.
To the When Diplomacy Fails special on the 30 Years' War.
The July Crisis Anniversary Project.
The Swedish Deluges.
Britain goes to war.
The 1916...
To the Franco-Dutch War of 1672.
This is When Diplomacy Fails, remastered. Hello, history friends. Welcome to this collaboration. Today I am joined to talk about the Boxer Rebellion, thankfully, because I need a teeny-weeny bit of help for a number of reasons. I am joined by Chris Stewart from none other than the History of China podcast, which you can find by going to, well, very simple, straightforward, really, thehistoryofchina.wordpress.com. Go and support Chris. Go and check him out. His podcast is top quality, which is of course why he is here, and he gives us some great insights, and we talk about a whole range of topics to do with the Boxer Rebellion and imperialism and all sorts of stuff, and I had a really good time doing it. Chris is a great guy. He's also a member of the Agora podcast network, which you should check out as well, and it was great having him on for this 5 year birthday party. Just a teeny tiny note about what you're about to listen to, whatever it is about Chinese broadband. Perhaps they don't like us talking about their history for a number of reasons, but yeah, occasionally the signal gets a bit iffy, and you'll be able to know what I mean when I say iffy. It's not by any means throughout the entire episode, it only happens two or three times, but I've been very fortunate by recording these episodes through Skype, of all things, would you believe, that the signal's been generally quite good. This is the only episode really where it kind of flashes in and out a tiny bit. I got rid of the worst of it, don't worry about that. But yeah, just so you know what's to come. It does not, by any means, take away from the episode. It's not Chris's fault either. He's just doing what he does best, talking about China. And this time, he's talking about China with yours truly. So I hope you enjoy it, guys. And I hope you'll let us both know, both me and Chris, know what you thought about the episode. Because we both had a great time. Enjoy, guys. Thanks, and I'll be talking to you very soon. Welcome to another collaboration episode, History Friends. My name is Zach, and as always, I'm joined by an esteemed guest in history podcasting. Today, I am flattered, humbled, and honored to be joined by Chris Stewart from the History of China podcast. How's it going, Stewart?
It's going very well. How are you, Zach?
I'm very good, thanks. Very, very good. And thanks for joining us. I believe you are
well,
all
thanks
the way...
for having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I believe you are all the way on the other side of the world right now. Well, to me, anyway.
to most of us. I'm in Shanghai, China. Yes.
Great. Well, that means you should have a fairly reasonable experience of basically what the Boxer Rebellion is, how to pronounce all the names, which still trip me up, and really set it in more context than even I did, because let's talk a bit about your podcast before we get into this. I mean, Sure. How would you describe your kind of, I mean, it's a history of China, which means it's not a Chinese history, which means it's in chronological order. Is that right?
That's right. Decided that what I wanted to do was take Chinese history from the very beginning of, well, Chinese history and work forward from there. It started out as just kind of me wanting to put a sense of perspective and understanding just for myself, and it turned into this whole gigantic project. Right now, we are actually at the very end of the Tang Dynasty in the early 10th century.
Wow. Okay. Cool. And what episode number are you on?
118, I believe.
Right. So a good in-depth, but not too over the top, in other words.
No, we try to keep it accessible. The understanding is very much that most people listening are not going to have had much of a background in the subject prior to coming to the show. So we try to keep that in mind.
Sure. Oh, that's cool. And I believe you, like When Diplomacy Fails, are on Patreon.
We are indeed. That is, if I may plug it.
Oh, please go for it.
It's patreon.com/thehistoryofchina. Keep it simple.
Big time. As someone who has also joined Patreon, I mean, I like breaking the fourth wall in these episodes. This will come out in about June, but I'm obviously we're recording it in March, so that's just the way it is. But very recently, in other words, I set up the Patreon and it's been going really, really well, and I'm very happy with it. So if anyone happened to, I don't know what are the odds of this happening, but if anyone happened to listen to your podcast, not realize you had a Patreon, and then come across this, then, well, they know where to go now. So, yeah.
Those four people will, you know, now they'll know.
That could be $20 each, though. You never know what might
happen. Hey, I'm not knocking it.
Well, cool. Well, we're kind of ready to get into this now. Maybe we should just start with a bit of background on the actual Boxer Rebellion itself, because we can't very well just jump right into it. And it takes a bit of scene setting, of course. So
absolutely.
Maybe how much you know, not necessarily about Chinese imperialism, but maybe just give us a general course of the way Chinese history went, maybe just in terms of the dynasties and how we got to the Qin dynasty by, say, 1900.
Okay. Well, as I'm sure many of us know very well, Chinese history is an extremely long and detailed sort of affair.
Surprise!
So let's see if I can boil this down. We get our first dynasty, it's the Zhou dynasty, and that's in about the 800s BC. And that, well, a little bit beyond that, but you get this period of rebellion, and it's supplanted by the so-called the Qin dynasty, which doesn't last very long, and then it's supplanted by the Han. And basically what you get is this cycle. It's the so-called dynastic cycle, where a new dynasty comes in and they claim the so-called mandate of heaven, which is, you know, the divine mandate to rule. It's akin to the European divine right of kings.
Sure.
And it's this, you know, lovely backwards facing sort of post facto justification where we won the rebellion, so obviously heaven was on our side the entire time. But if you didn't win the rebellion, well, obviously you were just a rebel.
Yeah, very, very convenient.
Oh, it's extremely convenient if you win, yes. And on until we hit the 13th century, and surprise, it's the Mongols. They're knocking on the door, and then they kick the door in, and they take over. They take control of China, pretty much the rest of Asia. And they established themselves under Kublai Khan as the Yuan dynasty, which established itself so firmly that even the Chinese consider it to be a legitimate dynasty of China, even though it's a conquest dynasty. But after they kind of weaken, they're kicked out by the so-called the Ming dynasty, which is once again a Han Chinese ruled dynasty. The Ming go ahead and they rule until about the 1640s, when we get kind of the cousins of the Mongols, which are the Isin Goryeo Jurchen, also known as the Manchu people.
I'm glad I didn't have to pronounce that.
That's why I'm here, you know?
Yeah.
The Manchu people from up north of the Korean Peninsula, they're cousins to the Mongolic peoples, but they're kind of more settled. They're a farming people, not so much nomadic. Regardless, they rise in rebellion. They were a part of the Ming sort of hegemony. But they rise up in rebellion against the emperors who become weak and corrupt once again, and they declare themselves to be the Qin. And just a little bit of a name game sort of background. The word Ming actually means bright, and it's made of the characters for the sun and the moon, both of which have fire characteristics to them.
Oh.
The Qin word means like pure or clear, and it has the characteristics of water and blue water. So it's kind of this idea, this sort of symbolic idea of water putting out the fire.
Right.
The name choice, which is kind of interesting.
Okay, I see. Very, very, very effective, like imagery-wise, kind of.
Yeah.
Very, very clever. They knew what they were doing with their names, in other words.
It seems to have been very, very deliberate, yeah.
Right, right. So the Qing, does the Qing take us up right to modern? Well, not modern, but 1900-ish.
So yeah, the Qing, they ride down from the north. They end up taking control of China with a lot of ethnic Han help, granted. But yes, that takes us, they are going to take us all the way to the end of the Chinese dynasty's tradition altogether. And they're only ended in 1911 with the Qinghai Republican Revolution,
sure,
which will create the Republic of China.
Hmm. Very good. Well, no, that wasn't so bad, was it? You did a good job, I think.
Well, thank you. I tried.
Cool. Well, that kind of sets us up well. I know for my part, I like my interest in China normally draws me there when the kind of colonization and European imperialism starts to happen, and it really starts to happen with a vengeance. The Opium Wars are mostly known of today from between the 1830s and 60s when Britain basically fought the Chinese for the rights to sell its drugs there so that it would be able to access tea easier and lovely stuff. So that brings us then, after that experience in imperialism, and of course the French got in there as well, they had Indochina.
Oh, yes.
And through a series of conflicts, then the Chinese power was gradually weakened to the point that by the end of the 1880s, the Japanese were on the scene, and it seemed like a new Asian power was encroaching on the Chinese kind of staying power, if you like.
Yes.
And then 1894 to 95, you had the Sino-Japanese War, which basically transformed massively the actual balance of power in Asia. And in a sense, it kind of confirmed what was already known, that after so much years of imperialism, the Chinese basically couldn't hold their own against what were, well, the Japanese were essentially a westernized power in every way but name, really, by this stage.
Yeah, and it's interesting that Qing China in the mid-1800s, they both realized at pretty much the same time that they were completely outclassed by the Western imperial powers, who were taking a very keen interest in them as well. The Meiji Restoration's, you know, considerably more famous. But China also was undergoing its own what's called the self-strengthening movement, or the Zhejiang Yundong, 1861 until the mid-1890s.
Hmm.
But unlike the Japan's restoration, which was, you know, tremendously successful, China's self-strengthening movement was only a very limited success, mostly because of its own internal bureaucratic corruption and sort of graft and these things that crop up time and time again in Chinese bureaucracies.
Sure.
Then and before and now. And then there was the additional facet of the overt hostility to letting any foreigners in on any projects that they wanted to build at all. They wanted to sort of do it all themselves and not let any, you know, Westerners or foreigners or any of their designs in.
Mm-hmm.
And so it leads to these weapons and these ships that are, you know, roughly on par with the Western models, but they're much more expensive to make. There's a whole lot fewer in production. Half of the courts, pushed by a guy named Prince Gong, he wants to westernize, he wants to modernize, but the Empress Dowager, Cixi, she's very anti-Western, she's heads up the conservative element of the government, which, you know, they used to say, you know, didn't want to westernize at all, didn't want to do any of these reforms, but more modern scholarship is saying, well, they just wanted to go more slowly, they wanted to roll out these reforms in a more controlled fashion. It sort of depends on what side of the coin you fall on. We don't really know.
Yeah. I found with Cixi or Xershi, or like, she seems to have a lot of different names depending on what mood I'm in when I choose to pronounce her name. But I think, yeah, that this is the lady, this is the individual that will take us up to the Boxer Rebellion. And she has a fundamental part to play in it, doesn't she? She has a very interesting story. She's a very interesting story behind her, because it's not like she started out as like the wife of the emperor. Mm-hmm. She started out as like a concubine and kind of like worked her way up then.
Cixi is one of the really singular women in Chinese history. She's right up there with, I mean, really only compare her with the only woman emperor of China, which is Empress Wu. And it's really her and Cixi. They stand apart from just about every other woman in China, just because their rises to power share a lot in common. As you said, they both start out as these lowly concubines, and then just through their own ruthlessness and intellect, just desire for power, come to be the puppet master behind the throne.
It's a very interesting story. It's almost a shame that the side that she chose to weigh in on was in fact the one that would lead to the depredations of the Boxer Rebellion, but
ultimately her own dynasty's destruction. Yeah.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, so we can say, oh, she had like great tact. She was lots of guile and all that kind of thing, and she was wily enough to know what to do. But the engendered like stagnation that really needed a kick by this stage. And I found, I don't know if you struggle with this, but when I'm looking at Chinese history, I find it difficult to basically say, okay, like the Chinese had their problems, but I find it difficult to say that the Chinese had their problems without making it sound like I'm letting the imperialists off scot-free, if that makes sense. As in, how do you say, like, you can't blame everything that happens in the Boxer Rebellion purely on the Western powers, or can you? Can you blame the fact that China was, like, kind of in the throes of the twilight years of its dynasty? Can you blame that on the imperial powers, or can you blame that on the Chinese themselves?
Well, I think I'm in the same boat as you. I can't say I blame either piece of this puzzle, you know, independently. I think in the Chinese case, it was with both the Ming and to a lesser extent the Qing, they had both kind of, and Japan for that matter as well, they adopted this sort of closed-door policy in the 17th and 18th centuries. At any other point in history prior to that point, if they had done this, and they'd done it before, it wouldn't have been a problem because the technological, you know, progression had been at such a relatively slow pace that you could close your country off for 100 or 200 years and come back and, oh, you're still, you know, at the top of your game compared to everybody else. But that they chose it to do it just by dumb luck at the time where Europe was starting to kick off its industrial revolution and the age of exploration, it really blindsided them when, oh, by the way, we have now cannons and muskets and ships and we're knocking at your door and you're still using crossbows.
Yeah, I think, Tom, I think there was a lot of, I don't know if denial is the right word to use, but this belief that within China and the Chinese government that they knew better. So like whatever technological advances the West had, oh, they were just poor imitations of the Chinese version anyway, so we don't need to worry kind of thing. Do you think that's a fair thing to say?
Absolutely. I mean, and it's not limited to the Chinese worldview at all. I'd say just about every culture, especially powerful culture, adopts it to one extent or another. But the Chinese were very much of a view that they were the literal centers of the universe. Everything revolved around them. They were the creators of everything good and useful. And if the Europeans got any of their technology, well, that was a sad sort of mistake. But, you know, maybe the barbarians would be able to use it. But they certainly couldn't do it better or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And they were proved wrong.
I'd like to talk just a little bit about the kind of situation. I don't know how much you know about this because I'm aware that you're not up this far in your podcast just yet. Mm-hmm. But the actual domestic situation by the 1900 when the Boxer Rebellion breaks out, it's a bit of a strange situation because Cixi has monopolized power for herself, essentially, and her nephew, the emperor, who I pronounced as Wang Shu, but I believe that's not exactly correct.
I think you're pretty much right on that, actually. So Guangxu, yeah.
Oh, okay, cool. Well, I was close enough, as close as I think I'll ever be. I did better than I did the first time around, which is, it's good enough for me.
You're right on.
It's good enough for me. But yeah, the actual domestic situation in China, it was unusual, mainly because, well, I suppose she wanted to monopolize power for herself, and her nephew was kind of part of not the modernizing, like, kind of movement. I don't want to make it sound more kind of ahead of its time than it was, but certainly Cixi represented kind of the old order, and her nephew represented a new, fresh face, and she did not, under any circumstances, want to let that fresh face take over and change China.
Well, yeah, I think your characterization is pretty much right on. Guangxu, he was a very young guy, self-strengthening movement had kind of petered out by the early 1890s. But then in 1898, Guangxu institutes this really concentrated attempt to sort of reinitiate that self-strengthening and that westernization movement. So your characterization of him as being much more gung-ho about the sort of modernization and westernization, I think you're right on with that.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and it's called the 100 Days of Reform, or the 100 Days Reform.
Oh, yes, I remember that. Yeah, yeah.
And it ends, as you kind of alluded to, with Cixi and her cronies basically shutting that show completely down and locking Emperor Guangxu in his room and performing a coup d'etat and seizing power for themselves and then unmaking all of those reforms over those 100 days.
You said before it kind of contributed to the end of the dynasty, really. I mean, do you think that, I don't know, I don't want to get you in trouble in case Big Brother is watching, but do you think that this fact that like it contributed to the end, like the Boxer Rebellion, I don't know, how is that actually seen today in China, if it is at all seen?
Oh, that's an excellent question. And don't worry, you're not getting me in trouble. The Boxer Rebellion in particular is seen, it's actually really interesting, the way that the cross-strait sort of idea of it has come about. And when I say cross-strait, for anyone who's not necessarily sure what I mean there, I mean the Taiwan Strait. So we've got the People's Republic in China today, which controls the totality of mainland China, so-called communist state. And then in Taiwan, we've got the Republic of China, as they call themselves, although the PRC frowns on anyone else using that name.
Or indeed trading with them at all.
Or trading with them or taking phone calls from them or anything
or,
of the sort.
Or using their phones, because don't HTC phones get made there, I think.
Yeah. I believe that is a Taiwanese brand. Yeah. It's interesting, especially the breakdown in those two societies, where in Taiwan, a lot of historians, they look at the Boxers as kind of xenophobic, ignorant, sort of superstitious weirdos. That's a lot of interpretation that comes out of Taiwanese school.
Sure.
Versus in the PRC, interpretation is kind of shunned, and instead they view them as patriotic, anti-imperialist, you know, go-getters. Quite a stark difference.
Big time, yeah. And is there any kind of realization or like acceptance that the kind of the Boxer Rebellion really touched off like the beginning of the end of, well, a big epoch in Chinese history, really, because after this, kind of the dynasty's on a downward spiral and essentially it's all over a decade later. But is there any kind of sense that, I see, again, I'm falling into the trap. I don't want to make it seem like it was the Chinese fault, but is there any kind of sense today that the Boxer Rebellion was a bad thing because it led to the revolution in 1911 and further downward spirals down the line?
Well, let me address that first and foremost of the Chinese understanding of it today. I think I can say for both sides of the, both Taiwan and the mainland, is that they view the Xinhai Republican Revolution as great and glorious and the ultimate path to restoration of their greatness.
Oh, I see.
They do not view the end of the dynastic system as anything bad, especially because it was the Qing. And the Qing was another conquest dynasty. It was not Chinese. The end of the Qing, the end of foreign domination by these Manchus was considered and is considered to be a fantastic thing by virtually everybody.
Okay, that's interesting. I just assumed because it would such a massive change from the way Chinese history had always progressed, I just assumed it would be seen as a bad thing. That's very interesting.
The people who led up to that revolution that would end the dynasty, they are considered to be the fathers of the nation. Sun Yat-sen, Chiang Kai-shek, and even Mao Zedong, of course, in the mainland.
Yeah.
They're all considered to be the people who brought China out of, you know, slavery and antiquity and into modernity.
Right. Okay, yeah. I suppose I can see that in a way. That kind of makes sense. Looking from my Western point of view, I can see that the Chinese, they didn't really have it very well after, like, a kind of imperialism continued almost on steroids after the Boxer Rebellion. So in my opinion, then, it would be seen as bad. But I suppose, on the other hand, the Westerners are going to imperialize either way.
Well, and then the other point I wanted to make on that exact topic, then, was that the Boxer Rebellion fits inside what's a larger understanding in the Chinese history and worldview, which is known as the Century of National Humiliation, which actually begins with the First Opium War. And ends with the end of the Second World War.
Oh, I can see the grounds for calling that a Century of National Humiliation would be
absolutely
fairly accurate, I think. I said in the original one that I think that the Opium War was probably the worst thing that the British ever did, and this is coming from a guy who's from Ireland. Like, there isn't really much like you mentioned the famine, the potato famine over here, and people suddenly get all patriotic and stuff and raise a glass to the famine, but at least the British didn't fight us so they could sell us drugs, you know. It could have been worse, I suppose. But let's talk a little bit about the boxers themselves, because I always find this very interesting. And actually, I mentioned this in the five-year-old episode, the original one, and I mentioned it in the remastered one because I found it so interesting. There was a movement in, just to kind of provide some kind of comparison to the boxers, there was a movement in amongst Native American tribes in the 1890s called the Ghost Dance Movement.
Yes.
And they basically put forward the same kind of ideas as the boxers did, that, oh, they're invulnerable to bullets, with a lot of concentration and meditation, you can resist the Western influences and all that kind of thing. I don't really know how to pose a question about that, but I just thought, were you aware of that, or indeed of any other examples of kind of like boxer mentality spreading across the world?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the ghost dance, because I'd actually written that down in notes as a comparison. Yeah, and it's, from what I've read about it, you actually find this pop up in a lot of sort of millennialist, sort of doomsday kind of societies that are facing potential either extermination or, you know, drastic world-changing epochal shift kind of things. If I remember correctly, there were certain societies in sub-Saharan Africa that also adopted this very similar thing to the ghost dance or to the boxer sort of focusing chi to deflect bullets kind of things. So you do see this pop up in societies that are facing imperialism, conquest. It's societies that are fundamentally breaking down, and so you get this sort of doomsdayist magical thinking kind of.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Thing. And I think the thing that it's important to remember with the boxers, certainly, but also the Native Americans with the ghost dance, and also the African populations, is these are primarily extremely young people, extremely young men. I mean, we're talking teenagers for the most part. There's virtually no 30-year-olds in any of these movements, you know? So they are, I mean, you think to any 15, 16-year-old kid, and they are going to be more susceptible to this kind of giving into stress and sort of magical thinking and potentially being a bit more vulnerable to the more eccentric ideas that, that others might put forward, especially in times of great stress.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I get that completely. And I mean, great stress really epitomizes what was going on in China at this time. The boxers themselves, though, I just found it interesting because you said that they didn't really have anyone really other than kind of like the young people. But I mean, Zixi was a huge kind of, I don't know necessarily if you call her a convert, but she certainly believed in them enough to issue a whole load of orders, basically saying, leave the boxers alone. The boxers are good, kind of thing.
Well, she kind of did that. She did that once it kind of became clear that the eight power alliance of the West was not really going to back down and that the boxers might be something that she could utilize against them. She was kind of, she wasn't like a super convert to their ideas or beliefs. I would put forth that she, in her very, you know, conniving empress way, used them just like she'd use any other tool. She saw it as something that she could potentially make use of.
Yeah. And as well, I think when we come back to the idea of who was and who wasn't following them, the entire south of China essentially didn't, like, parts of it didn't even know about the Boxer Rebellion.
Absolutely, and that was very calculated. One of the things that we gotta understand is that China at this time, it might have, you know, looked like a single nation on a map, but it was in the process of beginning to break apart into its constituent regions. Following the 1911 revolution that saw the end of the dynasty, it wasn't like, oh, well, now it's just the Republic of China and it's still just one thing. We get this whole warlord period of warlord states that are fighting against each other. And this was already happening, certainly in the 1890s. So especially in the south of China, you had a whole bunch of governors who basically get the order from the empress saying, hey, we're going to war, guys. And they just, they pocket it and they don't say anything. And they make sure that none of their people hear about it. And they stay neutral.
So this is kind of like the beginning of the generalissimos popping up all over the place, really.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Wow, yeah. I often found it interesting, even that a country the size and like density of China was able to kind of stick together. But I suppose at this stage, it really wasn't sticking together at all.
Well, it's this, it's another sort of a Chinese cycle to the point where there's the old phrase that stems all the way back to the Three Kingdoms in the third century, which is, you know, China is a country that if long united, it must divide. And if long divided, it must unite.
Yeah, that's accurate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can certainly see that in this case. It just struck me as interesting because people who, well, even myself originally, when I just thought the Boxer Rebellion, I was like, oh, it's a Chinese rebellion against the entirety of the West kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's not. It's a very small movement. And most people in their desperation turn to it because, well, they have very few other options. This is probably putting you on the spot a bit. But can you think of any like examples of kind of like Western imperialism in particular? I mean, the big one for me is spread of Christianity, which kind of, it really divided Chinese opinion and drew some really strong protests, mainly because a lot of the Chinese converts, they did so disingenuously a lot of the time to escape kind of national law. In other words, so what you often have, and now this didn't happen all the time, but sometimes a runaway Chinese prisoner could escape from his local kind of guards and then convert to Catholicism and then maybe hide in a Western embassy. I know that didn't happen all the time. There was genuine converts, but examples like those were essentially a prisoner found asylum in foreign justice was seen as completely unfair. And I mean, rightfully so, like basically taking advantage of the situation. Is there any other kind of examples? I mean, Christianity is the one that sticks out to me as the kind of the big bugbear of Chinese nationalism.
Yeah, and I think you're right on with the Christian missionary work being kind of tolerated, but only barely. And as you say, this proved a real sticking point. I think just right before the Boxer Rebellion, another society that was kind of similar to the Boxers, but it was called the Big Swords. They burst into this monastery in northern China, and they end up murdering two German priests,
It
triggers this whole international backlash, and suddenly Germany, Russia, Japan, and Britain, and I don't think the U.S., but maybe, they were all trying to get concessions out of China for it. Mm.
this was, I believe, sorry to interrupt you, this was like this is the beginning of demanding land rather than kind of monetary concessions, and that was kind of what touched off the scramble for, I mean, the scramble for China had been happening since the 1830s, but this was what really kind of touched off the whole, we need a port, the Chinese have a port, that port is our port now kind of thing.
Yeah, that had also gone back to the Opium Wars as well, forcing over Shanghai, was Xiamen, and prior to that, Guangdong or Canton had been the only port open to foreign trade, but the British had to force open three or four other ports all along the Chinese coast, and also take away Hong Kong as well.
Sure,
But then the other Christian thing that I remember right offhand is that there had been a temple to the Jade Emperor, which is the highest god in the classical Chinese sort of Taoist pantheon.
Right.
And that had been converted in the 1860s into a Catholic church, which, you know, made a whole bunch of people in the area understandably rather miffed. And you're turning our temple to our highest god into some other god's house of worship. That ended up forming into a Boxer attack, I think, right before the rebellion.
Mm, I'm not surprised. They weren't exactly the most sensitive of proselytizers at this time. Yeah, I mean, it certainly didn't help matters. It didn't seek to calm nerves or anything like that. I know that when the Boxer Rebellion kind of erupted, if you like, one of the major targets were Christians, and...
Yes.
Arguably even more of a target were Chinese converts to Christianity, and that's why you had a lot of them seeking refuge in the kind of foreign embassies.
Absolutely, yeah. Christians, foreigners in general, Chinese converts who were deemed to be essentially race traitors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think there'd always been a kind, as much as there was in the West, of course, but the kind of latent racism, and my dad always proves the example that the Chinese word for a foreigner is the same for barbarian. But is that actually true?
At one point, some archaic words do have that sort of affixment or attachment or that component to them. The modern word, no, absolutely not.
Okay.
modern word just means outside country person. That's all it means.
Okay. My dad will be very disappointed.
but he's not wrong. It's just many of the older words for especially China's neighbors that directly surrounding it, it was quite derogatory. It was like, you know, the bug people, the snake people, the all of which was considered highly derogatory.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the British called the Irish people worse. I mean, they never called us the bug people, but I mean, some of those cartoons in Punch were pretty, like, I find them funny, but back then I'm sure they were pretty offensive. But I want to just, speaking of kind of like propaganda, well, not propaganda, but kind of cartoons, I just want to point to that famous image of the picture of the Chinese kind of, it's like one of the most famous images in propaganda history, but it's like that cartoon with the Chinese kind of official in the background and the kind of pie of China on the table and all the powers kind of around it, cutting it up into pieces. You have Victoria, you have Tsar Nicholas II, you have kind of the Russian, the German Kaiser, you have France, and you have Japan. And I mean, this kind of, it really captures the mindset of how the Chinese saw themselves, but also how the world saw China as well. Like, this was in a French journal now in 1898. So this was before the actual Boxer Rebellion broke out. But it kind of made me think about what the people in their own countries thought about the Chinese being carved up. Because it's not like this was a Chinese cartoon that was used to kind of bolster national confidence. This was developed in the West. Like, this cartoon was developed in the West, and it kind of depicted... that, like, I mean, you could see in the picture the Chinese official obviously being very upset and saying, stop cutting up my country pie, for lack of a better term. But do you think that people from the West were maybe, I don't want to say that they were kind of remorseful, but do you think they were aware that the fact that carving up China might not have been such a good thing?
Putting myself back into that time and that position, you know, I don't think that they would have seen it as remorseful. I don't think there would have been any kind of a moral qualm about that. Just like I don't think there was anything of a moral qualm in the race for Africa, or the Americas, for that matter. I mean, the colonization drive was, it was just, you know, economically imperial, but there was also that moral component to it as well, where these people had constructed these very elaborate and very convincing, at least to them, reasons as to why they were doing this and why it was ultimately in, you know, this people to be colonized best interest. We're spreading Christianity, we're spreading civilization, we're spreading our technology, we're trading, we're opening up the world. Isn't this wonderful? Why would you fight this kind of a thing?
Yeah. Oh, I get that. Yeah.
Even shooting forward for a second, once Japan sort of becomes the hegemon of East Asia, what they called their empire as they expanded across the Pacific and into China and Southeast Asia, what was their name for it? It was the Greater East Asian Co-Prosperity Sphere.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Very, very happy sounding name.
Yeah, some kind of cooperative or something like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's, you know, smiles and sunshine and rainbows for everybody.
Yeah, as if there'd be like this lovely cooperative we could all draw upon equally. Mm-hmm. And no sign of slavery or hard labor or being drained of your resources. No.
Perished thought.
Yeah, very good. Well, let's talk a little bit about the actual Boxer Rebellion itself, when it starts. And I mean, it starts and it, I don't know, I don't think you could say it took the Western powers by surprise, because I mean, there's only so far you can push people before it kind of erupts. But once it breaks out, then you need, like, you have all these embassies that are basically under siege in Beijing, so you need to rescue them. So they send in sailors, they send in what's called a Seymour expedition.
Right.
And once that it reaches Beijing in about the middle of June, and they're transported by train, but the railway had been severed by the Boxers, and it kind of it adds to a bit of the panic in amongst the embassies. And I think there's a kind of standoff for a very long time. How much do you know about that kind of time?
Seymour Expedition, I know it had permission to be in Tianjin, which is about 120 or so kilometers southeast of Beijing. So quite close, but still far enough away where they'd need a train. And so they had permission to be there. But then Seymour, Vice Admiral Edward Seymour, that is, he decides he needs to go, as you say, rescue the diplomats that are now barricading themselves inside of their quarter of the Forbidden City in Beijing. They'd figured out very quickly that the Qing dynasty was not messing around. When the German diplomat goes and tries to make his way to the throne room to try to present his complaint about this, and he's cut down in the street by some officer. And so at this point, there's, oh, wow, well, this is, you know, obviously we can't do anything. So they end up barricading themselves in their region of the capital. So anyway, yeah, as you were saying, Seymour, he tries to make his way to the capital from Tianjin. And he's got about, I think it's about 2,000 or so, maybe a little bit more than 2,000 troops with him.
Yeah.
There's this multinational force. I think it's primarily Japanese and Russian with, you know, smaller numbers of all the other eight powers.
Mm.
And it's this weird thing because they get to this place called Langfang. They're ambushed, about 5,000 Chinese. About 2,000 or so of them are actual Boxers. And then the other 3,000 are this other group called the Gansu Braves. And they're actually Muslim troops from Western China.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
Hmm.
They've kind of allied together in defense of the Qing dynasty. The sort of rallying cry was to revive the Qing and destroy the foreigners. That was the banner that they flew under. The Chinese, they're attacking in these human waves. They feel like they cannot get hit by bullets. The cannon's just going to bounce right off of them, which is going to freak anybody out. These 5,000 dudes just running at you. They don't care if they get hit or not.
The 5,000 Chinese, they attack this deputation of 2,000 or so troops, and they win a victory, essentially, don't they?
Yeah, they do. A very costly victory, but a victory.
Yeah. And this kind of pushes the Western powers kind of back into Tianjin, and then because of that, then there seems to be no hope of relief for the beleaguered embassy people.
Right. It's looking very grim for the diplomats and the Christians and the civilians who are locked away in Beijing. And the Eight Nation Alliance actually sends the Empress to they send her this ultimatum demanding this total surrender of all her military and financial powers to this foreign alliance. That's really what pushes her into fully backing the Boxers and the Gansu Braves, because it's this demand for total capitulation, essentially, yeah. Which is, you know, what else could she possibly do?
Exactly, yeah, of course. She doesn't really have a choice at this rate. They basically made an enemy out of her, and mm-hmm. now because of that, she's forced into throwing her lot in with arguably a lost cause, because she must have known that, I mean, the Boxers couldn't resist forever kind of thing.
They're people who walk around with bare shirts, with bare chests, carrying nothing more than spears and swords, going up against cannon and gunfire. I think she must have known that there was going to be problems down the road.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, there was a good bit of conflicting attitudes within the Imperial court as well. There was, like, some of the Imperial soldiers actually fought alongside the Boxers, and some of them did not. I mean, we already pointed out in the south there was essentially no support of the rebellion whatsoever.
Right.
I think, well, let's talk about the Eight Power Alliance actually sending over its force, and that famous scene of the Kaiser Wilhelm saying basically, like,
oh yeah,
and he was unfortunate enough to use the word Hun, and ever since then, even though he was very much playing a part in the kind of mood of imperialism and revenge, certainly at the time, for killing the Western Christians, the term Hun really kind of came back to haunt him, really, for the rest of the Germans' lives.
Absolutely. Oh, man, that's got to be one of the most unfortunate turn of phrases there's ever been, because it has haunted Germany ever since then.
Oh, big time, yeah.
Kaiser Wilhelm, he commands his troops and sends this proclamation saying, should you encounter the enemy, he will be defeated. No quarter will be given. Prisoners will not be taken. Whoever falls into your hands is forfeited. Just as 1,000 years ago, the Huns under their King Attila made a name for themselves, one that even today makes them seem mighty in history and legend. May the name German be affirmed by you in such a way in China that no Chinese will ever again dare look cross-eyed at a German.
Yeah, I'd say 14 or 15 years later, he very much regretted saying that, but...
Oh, man, and the Americans and the Brits loved him for it, because that just wrote their propaganda posters for them.
Absolutely, yeah, and of course we know one of my favorite images is the German Kaiser kind of depicted as like a big spider with a web trapping all of the good other powers in it, and of course he's dressed as like he's... or, like, they depict him as, like, a big skeletal kind of figure, like,
mm-hmm.
reaching his kind of skeletal hand at like, the kind of good, like, the power of France, or, like, especially, like, picking up a Belgian citizen and about being able to eat them, like, he couldn't make it up, like...
Oh, it's no.
Really, it's quite fantastic.
The truly ironic thing, though, was that in this conflict, in the Boxer Rebellion, the Germans played almost no actual direct part in the suppression. They had a teeny number of troops as part of the alliance. I don't think they even made it to any battle on time. However, they did participate in the mop-up operations, which were horrible enough as it was. I mean, pillaging, looting, murders, rapes, all that stuff. Certainly did their part of that. But the minuscule nature of the German involvement is so out-magnified by the infamy that phrase has. It's pretty incredible.
Absolutely, absolutely. After the Eight Nation Alliance come in and kind of, they defeat the Boxers essentially, but so she retains her power and she kind of stays on afterwards, basically because mm-hmm. the Allies decide that it'll be too costly to get rid of her, and she, as a kind of puppet, she'd be useful.
Yeah, essentially in the course of this conflict, the Allies realize that almost kind of better the enemy that we know versus the enemy we don't. And they realized that they don't understand the Boxers or any of these other peasant groups. They don't understand the Chinese population or their mindset, but they understand the Imperial Court and they understand Cixi, and that's somebody who they can deal with directly. And rather than having China fragment into a million different pieces of, you know, hormonally addled teenagers with swords, it's better to keep her on the throne.
Sure, of course, of course. One of the reasons why the Boxer Rebellion so fascinates me is because of how it impacts Russia in particular, and how the kind of Anglo-Russian rivalry is really given a boost after this, because the Russians go on to kind of occupy Manchuria in the north of China, which is doubly bad. I mean, for the British, because it shows that the Russians don't seem to stop expanding, but for the Japanese, because they kind of seen China as their like playground, if you like, and it brings the British and the Japanese closer together and drives the British and the Russians further apart.
What the Russians do is they kind of take their part and they send in, you know, a couple hundred thousand troops into Manchuria to supposedly crush the Boxers.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's to occupy the territory, which has got to be an especially cruel blow to the imperial court, because that's their ancient homeland that's suddenly being invaded and taken away. In the terms of the treaty, they got, I think, most if not all of it back, because I think the treaty was that China wouldn't lose any of its territory and the Empress would keep all of her power over the country. But it certainly made everybody realize the power of Russia, at least over land, made Britain quite wary of that. It also made Japan quite wary of that. I mean, that feeds into the conflicts that would happen between Russia and Japan over northern Asia, get Japan much more interested in making sure that it could hold on to that area of the mainland of East Asia as well.
And I mean, we could talk a bit about just briefly, just even about the open door policy and how the Anglo-American interest really revolved around the idea of kind of keeping China open to trade with all countries, like on an equal basis, and stopping any kind of one single power from maintaining control over basically all of China, making China their puppet state. I think we can see that might sound, in a way, a nice thing to do. And certainly the propaganda made in America showed, like, Uncle Sam putting his foot down and stopping the other powers, like, carving up China for themselves. It's almost a foil to that pie cartoon that I mentioned earlier. It's kind of Uncle Sam is standing on the pie and the other countries are standing around with their knives and he's saying no, and he's holding up this document. It's I really do enjoy looking at the cartoons of this era. But
oh, they're fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. It provides a different kind of angle too. I mean, the British and Americans did this out of their own interest. I mean, they weren't doing it out of any love for the Chinese. It was to stop.
Oh, of course.
It was to stop the Russians in particular, because the Russians were building the Trans-Siberian Railway. And I had a talk episode, a collaboration episode, rather, with Mark Painter from the History of the 20th Century podcast, and we were talking about how when the Russo-Japanese War, which really is kind of touched off by this in a major way, Russo-Japanese War kind of happened once the Japanese realized that if they preemptively strike the Russians before they can finish their railway, then they'll have a huge advantage. But I think the impact of the railway at this stage, kind of opening China up, I suppose, more Russian imperialism. I mean, as far as the Russian end goal goes, it needed a warm water port. It only had Vladivostok, and that could freeze over during about half of the year. So they went for Port Arthur, and of course, we know how that went. The Japanese took it in a kind of an imitation of a prelude to kind of Pearl Harbor, if you like, an attack that took the Russians by surprise, destroyed their fleet, and kind of made the whole region kind of vulnerable to a Japanese attack. I don't want to get too much into the Russo-Japanese War, but
sure. No, I think you're right. I think that's very much fed into the Second World War's strategy in the Pacific. It worked so well last time. Kind of a thing.
Exactly. And that's what kind of me and Mark kind of came to the conclusion to. The Japanese were taught by this that attacking a power that seems stronger than you, taking away its advantages in one one fell swoop, it kind of worked. So let's do it again.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I think we're coming to the end of our collaboration episode now. I want to send a huge thanks to you, and would you like to plug your podcast once more?
Well, I sure would. Thank you very much once again for having me on, Zach. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Once again, I am Chris Stewart. I run the History of China podcast. You can find that on iTunes or anywhere else you'd like to look, or at thehistoryofchina.wordpress.com.
Cool. And if people would like to be your patron, that would be okay.
That would very much be okay. You can find me at patreon.com/thehistoryofchina.
Cool. Thanks very much for coming on, Chris. Really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Alrighty. What did we think of that? I, for one, had a really good time doing it, and I hope you had a good time listening to it. a reminder again, if you would like to let Chris know what you thought about it, that would be great as well, because if you spread the word about both of our podcasts, then that's doubly beneficial. And the thing that I loved about these collaborations is that I was able to, well, like, not only was it great to get people who do podcasts onto the podcast, but if I can share a little bit of the publicity, which I hope will come towards this podcast for having two episodes already, but if I can share some of the publicity, which I hope will be coming towards this podcast for having two episodes out every day, then that'd be great. And you guys can participate in the sharing of that publicity. How do you do that? Well, by checking out Chris's, well, website, by going to thehistoryofchina.wordpress.com. Also, find him in the usual places. And remember to support both of us, because we love doing this, we love doing history, and we love doing podcasting. And perhaps one day we will love you. Anyway, before we get weird, let's get out of here. Thanks for listening, guys. My name is Zach. We've been running wild. And I'll talk to you all soon.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.